Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes fought to keep his calendar private. Here's what it shows. Utah's growth could lead to a fifth congressional district. The new district wouldn't necessarily lean Democratic. And two student clubs cut ties with the University of Utah over new anti-DEI restrictions. Those are some of the headlines we'll be following today. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta is with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We'll be joined later in the hour by reporter Courtney Tanner as well. So, Robert, let's start with you. You've been on this story for a while. The Attorney General did not want his calendar made public, fought that. There were lawsuits, I guess, to get that released. And now what's happened to get that released?
Yeah, so the history of it is a little over a year ago. We filed a grandma request, an open records request for several years of the Attorney General's calendars. The thinking was we'd been doing some reporting on his relationship with Tim Ballard and his travel, campaign-related travel and other travel, how he was spending his time while he was on the job. And we thought these calendars would be the roadmap for, kind of piecing that together. The Attorney General denied our request. He also denied a similar request that had been made by a KSL TV reporter. And the Open Records Committee, the State Records Committee, ruled in both of our favors. And the Attorney General's office sued the Records Committee to try to block the release. So that dragged on for quite a while. During the legislative session in February, the judge in the KSL case ruled in their favor, said, yeah, these records are public records under the law. The same day that the ruling came down, the judge's ruling came down, the legislature changed the law. So going forward, all of our elected officials and public employees, their calendars are going to be private now. I guess the legislature didn't like the judge's ruling and wanted to reverse that. But it didn't apply to the pending requests that we had. So after some more legal wrangling, we ended up agreeing to settle the lawsuit in exchange for, we got just over 9,000 pages of calendar invites that Attorney General Reyes had received in the course of between 2019 and 2023. So 5 years of worth of records there. So yeah, we got those a few days ago. It obviously took us a little bit of time to go through them, and we finally produced our first bite at the apple. Posted it yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, you're listed first on the story, but others are involved. I guess it took a lot of you to go through all this documentation.
It was a team effort. There was a lot to digest, for sure.
So before we get into some of the things we learned from the calendar, remind us, Attorney General Reyes did not run for re-election. A bit of a cloud over him. Tell us why.
Yeah, there were questions that had been raised about his friendship with Tim Ballard, who was the founder of the anti-trafficking group Operation Underground Railroad. Tim was accused back in June of last year of sexual impropriety, and then eventually a couple months later, multiple women filed lawsuits against him alleging that he had sexually assaulted them and in a couple instances raped them. Those cases are still pending in the courts. He's denied that he did anything improper or wrong. So that was part of it. Tony Samrat also did some good reporting on, some of the campaign-related events that Reyes was paying for, including a trip to shoot feral hogs from a helicopter in Texas that was a fundraising event that he did. There were just these questions floating around of the legislature last fall asked for the legislative auditor general to do an audit of how Reyes was spending his time, what the decision-making process was like in the office, the efficiency of the office, and then whether this relationship with Tim Ballard had influenced the direction, I guess, of the attorney general's offices or the resources, how they allocated resources in the office.
Do we learn anything specific about those, you know, those questions, Tim Ballard and such, from these calendar items?
Well, so yes and no. I think mostly no. The part of the agreement was that the attorney general's office would not be releasing items in his calendar that were considered to be personal items or campaign related items. And so, and frankly, under the open records law, we only are entitled to get official records, right? So where they draw the line is kind of a subjective thing, I think. You know, if the attorney general is going to something that's a attorney general's association event or a Republican attorney general's association event, is that an official event or not? Some of those were included. I think some of them were clearly not. So we don't know exactly. We're not seeing the full picture, but we're seeing part of it. There were a couple meetings with Tim Ballard that were on his schedule. One with the CEO and founder of a company called Banjo that the state had a contract with for a period of time. There's a lot of anti-human trafficking meetings he's taking with all sorts of foundations, organizations that are working in that realm. A lot of tech companies that have software or things like that that they think that they can use to stop human trafficking, that sort of thing. So there's some of that. Probably, to be frank, not as much of the Ballard stuff as we thought, because, you know, one of the things that we tracked a year ago when we first made this request was just how involved Sean had been in promoting Operation Underground Railroad and promoting Tim Ballard. He received an executive associate producer credit on the Sound of Freedom movie that came out last summer. You know, and then, you know, he was promoting Tim to be a Senate candidate back in 2023. Obviously, that kind of fell apart when these allegations surfaced. So we know that they have this relationship, and there frankly wasn't much there. And so I think that's probably an indicator that that a lot of those events that Sean attended on behalf of OUR and with Tim and podcasts he recorded and such were considered to be exempt from the release that we got.
There's a section I want to have you go a little more in depth on here. Business pitches, I guess. Attorney General Reyes's advisor, Alan Crook, said this is just part of the deal. Tech companies and others want to pitch new products to attorneys general.
Yeah, a lot of them are law enforcement related, things like, you know, virtual reality, shooting simulators, things like that. There's AI related stuff that sort of, one of them that I thought was kind of interesting was a company that will timestamp bullets that are fired. So it helps in sort of reconstructing officer involved shootings, you know, on and on. I mean, there are sort of survey firms, marketing firms that wanted to the state business. There was one that was just a simple sort of email blast program or text blast program, so you can contact your constituents easily. You know, it's these meetings were week in and week out, you know, couple times every week, but you know, multiple times a month there were these meetings with these businesses that were looking for state contracts, and we haven't been able to check them all. Most of them, it appears, did not get state contracts. There was a facial recognition company that the state was looking at for a while, and they ended up not doing it because they weren't comfortable with the way the company was going to be using the data they were gathering, this facial recognition data. And since then, there's been class action suits and lawsuits by attorneys general in other states about how that was being used. There was a meeting with executives, and this is where it gets a little hazy, I guess I should say, that, you know, some of it is unclear. It's not clear that all of these were business pitches. One meeting in particular was with executives from a virtual rent-to-own company, which is a little unusual, I think. But, you know, around the time that they had this meeting, the Federal Trade Commission had imposed, I think it was a $172 million restitution order that they had to repay some of the customers because they had, you know, used misleading business practices or made false promises to these customers. So, you know, some of it may have been more in the Attorney General's law enforcement realm. Others may have been sort of in his role as, you know, the legal officer for the state, that where they're trying to get the state to sign a contract with them and buy their product.
A lot of this seems to, at least to my reading, to be, you know, kind of parsing, you know, because politicians have two hats on, right? So Attorney General Reyes is the attorney general, elected official. He's also a politician trying to build a personal brand. And so he traveled around the world. He would be involved in activities, you know, some of which official business, others more with the politician hat on.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And a lot of the stuff he was doing, again, from a political standpoint, would have fallen under the campaign umbrella that we didn't get. For example, after the 2020 election, when he went to Nevada to try to uncover evidence of fraud, right? That was not included in these documents. The campaign related junkets and fundraising events was not included. But he was, you know, he had made himself. The two issues that sort of were central to a lot of these meetings and events were, again, human trafficking and then opioid prevention. And he would speak at events sort of all over the country, certainly, and in some cases in foreign countries, about those topics, and take meetings with visiting dignitaries from other countries to talk about, in particular, those two topics. But sometimes it was also, you know, other issues. And you're right. I mean, this is not necessarily something we wouldn't expect. If you are a law enforcement officer or legal officer who has taken a keen interest in a particular issue, you're probably going to get invited to speak to it on podcasts or on documentaries, which he did. And so it's the fact that they're there is not surprising. I think there's it's kind of interesting or eye-opening how many of them there were over the course of the period of time that we had these records.
Overall, and so far, I guess you're still sifting through these. What do you think the top things you learned from these records are?
You know, I think I'm a little curious why he was so adamant about protecting these records. I mean, the state taxpayers ended up paying KSL $135,000 almost in legal fees. That's just for the legal fees for the time that KSL's attorney spent on it. It doesn't include the legal fees that were spent by, you know, paying the state's attorneys to handle both the KSL case and the Tribune case. So I was a little bit curious about that. I think, as we talked about, the business pitches part of it was interesting. There's some interesting information about a sort of satellite office that he had downtown in a private club, sort of an exclusive private club, speakeasy style club that's by Pioneer Park. And we'll be delving into that a little bit more. The sort of famous people that he was rubbing elbows with, or at least quasi-famous people, you know, Dr. Oz and you know, Clarence Thomas and John Kelly, the former White House chief of staff, and Bill Barr, the former attorney general, he had meetings with him. There's a lot of sort of prominent high-profile names that show up in this, but in terms of like a major bombshell revelation, I'm not sure that there's one there, but I think the overall picture still gives our readers a little bit of an interesting profile and what it's like to be Attorney General, I guess.
Finally, Robert, this case illustrates attention, obviously, right? The press, on behalf of the public, wants to you know, have our politicians, officials be open about what they're doing. Legislature obviously has made sure that these kind of email records will not be available in the future. I guess they would say we need to get about our business of of working for the people, and if the press is in every last little detail, maybe that's inhibiting. Maybe talk a little bit about that tension.
Well, it's hard for me to be objective on that one, because I think that they made too much of the tension, frankly. I it seems to me that we're paying their salaries. They work for us. We pick them and we can unpick them. When they're on the clock, when it's do official business, like these records that we got, it seems pretty cut and dry that we should know where they were. And frankly, the prior attorneys general, both Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow, regularly released their records when we requested them through an open records request. Obviously now I think we've lost that, which I think is not good for transparency and public accountability. I think it seems to me that, you know, the if you know, there were sort of horror stories during the legislative debate about this, that, you know, why don't we put body cameras on all of our public officials? So, and nobody was suggesting that. Nobody was suggesting we know, you know, when their kids, you know, swim meets or doctor's appointments or things like that are, you know, that's clearly outside the purview of, you know, public accountability. But if they're meeting with vendors who are trying to sell them a product, you know, for example, if he's promoting this national child ID program that he promoted extensively over the course of a few years, and you know, we have a right to question the validity of that program and the reasonings for all of these meetings. So it's always going to be striking a balance, I think, but you know, the balance that we had for decades seemed to be working, but now going forward, obviously the paradigm has shifted, and in the future we're not going to have access to those records, and I think that's probably a loss for the public and for accountability of our political elected leaders.
Robert Gerke, a news columnist, Salt Lake Tribune, telling us about this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, John.
After break, we're going to look at this headline. Utah's growth could lead to a fifth congressional district. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah's growth could lead to a fifth congressional district. The new district would not necessarily lean Democratic. That's the headline of the story we want to talk about next. We turn to Salt Lake Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom.
We're looking ahead to the 2030 census, trying to estimate this, but three groups who do this kind of work think that Utah will be among the states that'll gain at least one congressional district.
Yeah, so the Brennan Center for Justice, American Redistricting Project, and Election Data Services, they're just a few of the groups that track this. There's a lot more, but, you know, we don't want to overwhelm people. So just wanted to kind of show that it's not, you know, just two. So it's not a coincidence. We've got a kind of a pattern here of these groups saying that, you know, Utah got another seat two decades ago, missed out in this most recent census, but is likely to get a fifth once we roll around to the next one.
So, Utah famously lost out to North Carolina on that extra seat after the 2020 census. I guess there was a dispute over, do we count missionaries as residents, right?
Yeah, that's, I wasn't here, so obviously, you know, at the time was not following that. I think I was in college at the time, actually. Mm-hmm. But Miles Coleman, who's with UVA's Center for Politics, follows all of this pretty closely. And tell me that. And, you know, kind of joked, it's kind of a uniquely Utah problem.
So after each census, there is reapportionment process, dividing the House is capped at 435 seats, right? It doesn't just keep growing. So some states will lose seats and others will gain. I think Idaho is another one that's projected to gain. California in our area projected to lose. So where is this? I guess the first question is, As of about 2030, how big do we think Utah will be? What how many residents?
So Gardner has some projections that just around close to that 3.9 million mark. Their projections are actually a little bit more than Election Data Services, which is the only of these three that actually put a population total out for kind of explaining where they think that states will gain seats. But so getting, edging closer and closer to that 4 million in 2033, but pretty close to it already in 2030.
Where do we think the most growth will happen in Utah?
So, just like it does now, along the Wasatch Front, so you're looking at Utah County, Salt Lake County, Davis, and Weber, and Washington County is also supposed to grow quite a bit. And then, Tooele and Juab kind of get the outflow from Salt Lake and Utah counties.
And then there are some counties projected to lose population, I think.
Yeah, Daggett County has kind of just, flip-flopped back and forth in the last several years, and they're projected to kind of keep losing. It's not all that many people, but their population's not that big to begin with, so it's still a 7% drop. And then Millard County is supposed to lose probably right around 1,500 to 2,000 people between now and 2033.
And understand, projection is this growth will not so much come from babies. It'll be people moving in.
Yeah, that's been kind of a newer trend in Utah that most of the growth is coming from in-migration instead of that natural increase of people having kids.
And I think from your reporting, Utah projected to get a bit older.
Yeah, that's also just another growing trend, as people keep moving here and we have fewer young children, the age is naturally going to increase.
Though Utah is still one of the younger states, I think.
Yes, we're still predicted to remain, have that lower median age than pretty much every other state.
So we get to a very interesting part of this. Democrats especially might be thinking, oh, an extra seat. Maybe that'll be Democratic. And experts you're talking to say, hold on, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, it'll really just depend on, who's drawing the maps and who controls the process at the time. There's a way to split up Salt Lake County five different ways, just like it's currently split four different ways. But there's just no guarantee either way right now.
And so this particular issue is the subject of a Utah Supreme Court ruling, right, recently. So that may well have an effect on this.
It could. It kind of depends on how, this current ask to get the maps thrown out, just how that goes through the court right now.
One of the people you talked to used a tool. It was kind of a fun name, Dave's Redistricting or something. It's a tool you can use, and he just to illustrate how this might go, he just split Salt Lake County into five slices instead of four, and produced five Republican-leaning districts.
Yeah, because I mean, really the only, you're kind of supposed to keep communities that are alike together, but the only true requirement is that they're, evenly splitting the population. So there is a way to, just keep kind of splitting up Salt Lake County and keep splitting up that, primarily Democratic vote. I did think it was interesting, there two of them ended up being actually contained within the state instead of stretching all the way to the state borders like they do right now.
Yeah, so this will all come down to, I guess, what happens with that Supreme Court ruling and
Yeah, for sure.
what the legislature does. Yeah, anything else you'd like to say about this story, Megan?
No, I just thought it was really interesting. Followed redistricting in quite a few states and, seen independent redistricting commissions, kind of succeed in getting the boundaries drawn in different ways, and then also just kind of be taken as an advisory opinion that gets kind of tossed to the side.
Yeah, definitely. And there are states that do have independent redistricting commissions. Yeah. Well, thanks, Megan. Appreciate that. Before we go to underplayed stories of the week. I want to bring Robert Gerke back in on this one. I know you've been following this whole saga with the initiative, which produced an independent, would have produced an independent redistricting commission. The legislature totally kind of nullified that, drew their own districts. Now the Supreme Court weighed in. Are we the latest on this?
Right. So as you mentioned, after the Proposition 4 in 2018, the Better Boundaries Initiative was reversed by the legislature before its past redistricting. League of Women Voters and some other plaintiffs sued. The Supreme Court ruled in July that that because the people have a right to reform government through the ballot initiative process, simply undoing that would be exceeding the legislature's constitutional authority. That led us to the Amendment D, where the legislature called that emergency special session and wanted to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that said, yes, in fact, the legislature can repeal or amend any initiative at once. Amendment D, the language of the ballot initiative question, or of the amendment question, and was ruled invalid because it was misleading. So Amendment D was stricken from the ballot. The case right now, the underlying case where the court has said that, you know, the legislature has to abide or honor the will of the people through a ballot initiative, that's back in the district court. And the plaintiffs have asked for judgment in their favor, which would return us to the original language of the Better Boundaries Initiative and would presumably require the legislature to redraw the maps. Last Friday, there was a new filing from the state in it that said, well, we can't go back to the language of the Better Boundaries Initiative because that was an unconstitutional overreach by the public, because they said that the U.S. and state constitution gives the legislature exclusive authority to draw the maps. So the judge is going to be deciding, you know, whether or not that we need to go back to the Better Boundaries language and the Independent Redistricting Commission and the ban on partisan gerrymandering. If the judge rules again in the plaintiff's favor, we'll probably see some additional legal wrangling, appeals, and so forth. But potentially new maps, optimistically, I would say by 2026, more realistically by 2028, if the judge rules in the legislature's favor and says, you know, yeah, the ballot initiative passed, but it was unconstitutional on its face, then we won't get new maps. And frankly, if the judge rules that way, the potential for a meaningful independent redistricting commission in the future probably goes out the window. So, you know, there's a fair amount riding on it. These congressional seats are extremely important right now, especially because the U.S. House of Representatives is so narrowly divided. I think it's 3 seats after Matt Gaetz' resignation of the Attorney General, now 2-seat advantage for the Republicans. So there's a lot riding on these sorts of legal battles.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll keep an eye on this, and I know... you'll be following this, Megan, and other reporters will be following this closely. So let's do turn to our underplayed stories of the week. Megan Banta, what's your underplayed story of the week?
So mine is one that published this morning from at this highway that, you know, the Northern Corridor Highway that some state officials want to be built near St. George, and just kind of, you know, what could happen now that, you know, the presidential administration is going to shift back to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I guess more likely to get built with a new Trump administration.
It seems that way.
Yeah, and Governor Cox, I read, is pushing for it. Let's go for it, he's saying. Yeah, check that out at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, mine also, the one I'm picking, also published today. There's the federal government and the state of Utah finally finalized a big land swap, 200,000 acres in all. The federal government's getting about 116,000 acres in the San Rafael Swell, one of my favorite parts of the state. It's gorgeous. And the state's getting about 90,000 acres. The School Trust Lands Administration is getting 90,000 acres. And the good part for the state is that these 90,000 acres are going to be in areas that can actually, or they can actually do something with it. And the proceeds from this money that they would make off of it goes to schools. So this is, I just think it's important to highlight this because we've seen so many battles over public lands and management and the state suing the federal government and this and that, that this shows that, hey, there can be victories for both sides if people are willing to sit down and work it through.
Check that out at sltrib.com, all these stories as well. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune data enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And news columnist Robert Gerke has been with us. Robert, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
You too. Following a break, we're going to be treating this headline. Two student clubs have cut ties with the University of Utah over new anti-DEI restrictions. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll go to break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and on this part of the program, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks so much for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me, Tom.
So a couple of stories we want to talk to about. First, here's the headline. Two student clubs cut ties with the University of Utah over new anti-DEI restrictions. So I guess, first of all, remind us, HB 261, what that did.
Right. HB 261 is Utah's anti-DEI law. So that was passed this most recent legislative session in January. It was signed into law by the governor. And it basically took aim at diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts across higher education, also some in K-12 and government offices, but the thrust of it was higher education. So essentially, you know, colleges couldn't have any kind of program or effort that specifically catered to like a gender-based group or a race-based group.
So two student cultural clubs have chosen to cut ties with the University of Utah. Which are those?
Yes, the Black Student Union and the Pacific Islander Student Association at the University of Utah.
Now, these were sponsored clubs, right? So they got a budget, they had a place to meet, et cetera, et cetera. What will cutting ties mean?
Yeah, so the youth club system is kind of interesting. So you're right, these are sponsored groups, which meant that they had more support from the university. Like you said, they had like a specific place where they could come and gather, and they had, you know, money set aside for them. And that's what the youth says, you know, made them part of the university and like subject to this law. So cutting ties with the university now means, you know, that they don't have those kind of secure things. But what's interesting is these clubs said even with keeping that tie, you know, they were told they weren't going to have any funding. So it's kind of interesting. Like, it turns out essentially that, like, cutting ties doesn't mean that they weren't getting funding from the U because they already weren't getting funding under the bill.
Now, the leaders of these clubs said that they were assured by statements, I guess, by some legislators and by the university that that they wouldn't have to worry, but there were restrictions, I guess, that they couldn't accept.
Yeah, when Representative Katie Hall originally presented this bill during the legislative session, you know, she had made comments like, I don't think this is going to have a big impact. And she had said, you know, student clubs will be fine as long as they, like, you know, allow anybody to attend their events. And so, you know, these student clubs have kind of operated under that understanding that nothing was going to happen and that they were going to be fine. But then, you know, the youth starts rolling out the provisions of HB 261, you know, it closes cultural centers, and then it starts to say, you know, these sponsored clubs are, in fact, going to be subject to the rules of this.
So my understanding of it was that you could have a Black student union, but you need to invite everybody who wanted to come. But I guess there were more restrictions than that.
Yeah, and that these clubs, you know, were saying, look, we already invited everyone. Like, that wasn't an issue. And so they didn't think that they were going to have problems. But then the youth started saying, like, according to these clubs, that you couldn't have events that were focused on race. And that was a big problem for these clubs. I mean, like, the Pacific Islander Student Association was told they can't talk about colonialism, which is, you know, a really formative issue for a lot of Pacific Islander nations and peoples, you know, that had to deal with that. And the Black Student Union said that, you know, we can't talk about race, but the first thing that you see when you look at, like, students that are part of this club is their race, is their Black skin. And so there was a lot of frustration with these groups saying, like, look, you said this bill wasn't going to impact us, but now you're saying we can't even talk about the things that are really formative for the members.
What's University of Utah saying about this?
The U says that it had to do what it's doing, essentially had to enforce HB 261 on these clubs because they were sponsored, because they were seen as essentially arms of the university, that these clubs couldn't have been exempt from the rules under HB 261. The U also says that the Utah System of Higher Education issued some guidance, and that guidance specifically also included clubs, you know, that had formal ties with universities and said, look, like if this club is receiving funding, is kind of a formal arm of the university, then it is subject to the law. And so basically the U says, look, there wasn't anything we could do. We had to follow this.
One thing I noted in your story that I guess even communiques from the club would probably be reviewed. What they could say would be restricted.
Yeah, they were saying that they had to have, you know, any kind of social media post approved before they were allowed to send it out, and so they just felt like, you know, that they weren't being held to what they were told, that this wouldn't affect them. And then it was this really broad approach that everything they were doing was kind of being inspected by the U. And that's ultimately what made both of them decide, you know, we'd rather just be independent groups.
So the Black Student Union, the Pacific Island group, what are they saying about why they wanted these groups, why they still want these groups? What does it do for them?
Yeah, it was actually really heartening to hear these students talk about it. You know, a lot of them said, this is a home for us. This is a place where we found a family on campus. And, you know, others that had experienced the same thing as we've experienced. You know, one of the members of the Black Student Union talked about how, you know, she grew up in Utah. She was adopted by white parents. You know, this is a majority white state. The University of Utah is a majority white campus. And this Black Student Union was like the space for her to be with others like her, to, you know, talk about her identity, to celebrate it. And the Pacific Islander Student Association, the vice president there, talked about how, you know, that group was family and how, like, if someone needed to go to the doctor, they would drive them. It just was this place where they felt, you know, kinship, and they didn't want to lose that.
You talk to some people who go back in history a little bit. Black student unions formed out of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. For example, former faculty member Ronald Coleman, I guess, he went back to the Daily Utah Chronicle. He recounted his experience attending the school playing football. What did he say?
Yeah, it was really interesting to look at the history of this. So the union, the Black Student Union at the University of Utah, formed like a lot across the country. And I would highly recommend going to the Black Student Union's post on this, because they tell this really interesting history of how these clubs came out of the Civil Rights Act, and they capture it very well. But Ronald Coleman talked about how he experienced racism and bigotry when he was playing football for the U and couldn't find housing, in Salt Lake City that would accept him and other Black football players, that wouldn't let them live there.
The university, I hadn't remembered this, I guess the university itself started a George Floyd Memorial Fund. This was kind of different times, pre this HB 261.
Yeah, really interesting. There was all this kind of movement and I hate to say celebration when we're talking about, you know, a man that was killed, but a fund that was created in his honor to support Black students moving forward. And this was all in 2020. So we're not talking that long ago, 4 years, you know, the university was doing these posts that were celebrating the Black Student Union, celebrating this George Floyd Memorial Fund, creating a Black Advisory Council. And a lot of those efforts now are going away. You know, the Black Cultural Center was closed under this law.
So remind us what the sponsors of HB 261, what was their objection to DEI efforts?
I think that there was this concern that they weren't helping every student, right? That only certain students were getting support. And so HB 261 essentially said, you can't serve select student groups based on identity. You have to have kind of general student support that helps every student, regardless of their background.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Black students, University of Utah, about 1%. Pacific Islanders, even less, what, 0.3%, right?
Yeah, very small group here.
So what, they've lost funding. What are they going to do?
Yeah, both of them have set up fundraisers. So I would, if you want to help fund those, go to the article. There's links for both of those within the article. You can also reach out by email if you want. But yeah, they're just trying to raise money so they can keep holding the events that they used to hold, the Pacific Islander group, you know, used to have this high school conference where they would have Pacific Islander students on campus and, you know, show them what it was like to be a student. And now they're looking at not being able to host that. And so they are raising funds for that kind of thing.
Now, you know, your story, U of U is not the only university impacted. Utah State University closed down the Inclusion Center. And that center had a budget, right, which went to some events. Now that center's been closed down.
Yeah, and that is a good point. It isn't just the U that this is happening at. Every school is kind of handling this differently, but Utah State University used to have its clubs, its cultural clubs, hosted under this Inclusion Center, and those clubs would receive $1,000 annually. That's, you know, not happening anymore because that Inclusion Center was closed down, and so no clubs now are kind of receiving that same amount of money, these cultural clubs, and they're not allowed to host events like they might have in the past. Those events are now being held by the university at large. Really kind of wide impacts from this bill that, you know, the lawmaker at the time said, I don't think this is going to have wide impacts, but we're seeing that's not the case.
So some consequences from this that were not foreseen or expected by the sponsor, any word from legislature, whether they're going to revisit this?
You know, I haven't heard anything specific on that, but I wouldn't be surprised. But I also think the direction it would go would be to honestly clamp down more is kind of what we're seeing is to maybe even further restrict what's going on campuses. I mean, the Republican majority legislature here really has an appetite for that instead of maybe loosening the restrictions.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. I want to talk, Courtney, with you about another story, another higher ed story. Here's the headline. Ex-Utah Tech University president gave phallic gag gift to his VP, one of many misconduct allegations, a new lawsuit claims. So this is former president Richard Biff Williams, Utah Tech University in St. George. He resigned a while ago, right?
Right. He announced his resignation last December, but actually stepped down on January 5th of this year.
So what is the lawsuit claiming?
Yeah, it's a huge lawsuit. It's 42 pages, but kind of the big thrust of it is that when he was president, President Williams had left this gag gift for a vice president, a member of his cabinet, and it was this vegetable display. I'll be careful what we're saying on radio here. This vegetable display that was inappropriate, and he attached a note to it. But he didn't sign his own name to it. He signed the note as if it were from the university's top attorney, the second-in-command attorney, and the Title IX coordinator at the school. And so this lawsuit is from those three employees saying, look, you misattributed this gift to us. It was inappropriate. And it felt like to them that it was payback for their efforts to clean up what they said was a toxic environment at the school.
They say they got pushback, right, for reporting this, which, according to rules and laws, is not supposed to happen. So toxic environment, tell me a little bit more about what they're saying about that.
Yeah, and I should say that they say this toxic environment is coming from the very top. So, I mean, the President Williams example is kind of the key for them. But, you know, they have this long list of allegations within this lawsuit. At one point, they say that some of the deans at the school held this party that was mocking Title IX and the efforts around Title IX, and they passed around this like fake book called Title IX for Dummies. They say the other staff had tried to bully these three employees when they were looking into misconduct or when they found the misconduct had happened, you know, tried to retaliate against them. There's this part of the lawsuit that talks about crude quotes that had been said by staff members being hung up on the walls and kind of celebrated. And then there's also some allegations of racism within this, too. So really a wide-ranging lawsuit, retaliation, harassment, intimidation.
You point out in your story that President Williams appears he's landed on his feet, the new president of Missouri State University.
That's right, yeah. He was inaugurated there last month. It's probably worth pointing out he did issue an apology last weekend from Missouri State University, basically, you know, acknowledging that he had gifted this vegetable display and apologizing for his part in that.
What's happened to the folks, the whistleblowers, and I guess you could call them that, the people who reported this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'll start with Becky Broadbent, who is the top attorney for Utah Tech University. She's kind of faced the most repercussions. She was put on leave in February, which the university at the time said was, she says, was supposedly to protect her, but that's not what Title IX law says. You're not ever really supposed to put a complainant on leave unless, like, they request that. And so it's highly unusual that she was placed on leave as a complainant and not actually like an alleged perpetrator in the case. So she's actually still on leave about 9 months later, hasn't been given the okay to come back, even though, you know, the investigations are largely wrapped up into this case. And the other two employees, Jared Rasband, who's kind of the second in command attorney, and Hazel Sainsbury, who's over the Title IX office, both say that the environment at Utah Tech has just been so toxic for them in the wake of all of this, that they have people that like won't talk to them, that are telling people not to go to their offices. They're being kept out of meetings, you know, so that's kind of where the allegations of retaliation stem, is that this environment has gotten even worse since they reported the misconduct.
What does Utah Tech University say?
Yeah, it's a little bit challenging. I think you'll get kind of the same response in a lot of lawsuits. You know, they say, like, we can't really comment, we can't talk about these allegations because there's a lawsuit that's been filed, but the school says it's committed to working with these folks and trying to reach a resolution, and it says it takes their allegations seriously. So I it's a limited statement, but, you know, that's the gist of it.
I guess similar Utah system of higher education, I think they said they can't comment.
Exactly. And the Utah system of higher education oversees the public institutions in the state. And so it, you know, has this responsibility to oversee Utah Tech University. And it was involved in doing an investigation in these allegations. But yeah, it also says, you know, we can't comment at this point.
So President Williams, you say he apologized for the vegetable incident. Did he say anything about anything else that comes up in the lawsuit?
No, I think he's kind of keeping a low profile is maybe the right word, but he has hired attorneys to defend him, so I think that's maybe an interesting development in this. But yeah, mostly apologized, said that he's sorry for it bringing attention to his new university in Missouri.
So the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, what are they seeking specifically in this lawsuit?
Well, I think one of the big things they want is a cultural change here at the university, and for, you know, this to spur a fix to the problems that they face so that other people don't face the same thing for reporting misconduct. But they're also asking for a jury trial, award for damages. Those are pretty standard things to ask for. But, yeah, I think the biggest thing that they want is just, you know, take complaints seriously. These three people are who normally would handle complaints at a university, and their complaints aren't being taken seriously, they say.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
I think that about covers it. Okay. We'll be, you know, filing more. There's a Q&A that'll go online shortly with the three employees, so keep an eye out for that. But I will say, too, I guess the Tribune is fighting for the actual investigation that the university did in this case. We still haven't been able to get that. It's been about 6 months of us fighting for those records, but we'll keep fighting. And so I guess just keep an eye out on this for more reporting.
All right. Thanks for telling us about these two stories. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Do you wonder why you even try to plant a garden? Because everything you plant fails. Even the most challenged gardener can feel successful when planting fall bulbs. Tulips, daffodils, hyacinths, and crocus all need minimal care after planting, but what an amazing show of color they produce in the spring. All you do is dig a hole, put some bulb food in the bottom, and work it into the soil. Then lay your bulbs in the bottom of the hole, points up, cover them with loose soil, and then water thoroughly. Dig, drop, done. It's that easy. For the most spectacular display of bulbs, plant 5 to 7 bulbs per square foot and concentrate them in strategic areas of your yard to create dramatic focal points. You'll be amazed at how many neighbors will comment on the beauty of your yard next spring.
Support for The Garden Spot comes from Logan Extermination, serving Cache Valley for over 45 years, offering year-round pest control, lawn, tree, and shrub maintenance. Information at loganextermination.net.